With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to They Started It with Angelica Malin, the podcast that takes you on a journey from business idea to reality with a range of inspiring, dynamic CEOs and business leaders. I'm your host, best-selling author, entrepreneur and founder of About Time magazine, Angelica Malin. And in this series, we'll be discovering what it takes to make it as an entrepreneur, from mindset to hard business lessons with some incredible, inspiring guests. Don't forget to follow me on social media at Jelly Malin for all the behind the scenes of making the podcast. Now, let's find out how they started it. So I'm joined today by James and Tom Elliott, founders of Pizza Pilgrims. Thank you so much for joining me today. Can you tell me a little bit about your roles in the business and what kind of day-to-day looks like?
Absolutely. Do you want to take this one?
I mean, that's going to take
tell us you everything you need to know.
So we're both founders of the business. And I think sort of in the most cartoon version, this is the way I put it. I get to do all the creative fun stuff, and Tom is sort of everything else. But then there's inevitably a lot of crossover between our two roles.
Okay. Yeah, I think the way it's actually worked is that, you know, I can sit in a meeting about designing a pizzeria and completely zone out, and he can sit in a meeting about doing a lease agreement and completely zone out. And between us, we've got that covered.
Do you think it's beneficial for running the business that you have that kind of separation?
Absolutely. Not only because it means you've covered all bases, so like all the stupid balls you need to juggle to run a business are covered, but also if you're both fighting over the same bone, then you're not getting anywhere. So, you know, if we were both arguing about fit out stuff, then it would be counterproductive.
I also find it interesting how often your skill set and your just way of thinking is useful in my neck of the woods, and sometimes my way of thinking is useful in your neck of the woods. Because you're more analytical, so therefore analytical to creative is good. And sometimes
I fear we're straying into boring answer here.
Oh yeah, we might be. Yeah. Yeah.
Not at all. So I want to go back to the start and talk about starting the business. So how did the business come about, and how did it go from kind of a street food business to starting your own pizzerias?
Well, it started, I worked in advertising and you worked in TV production, so sort of media. And we both hated it. And I hated it and I was bad at it. So it was sort of a double whammy. And we'd grown up in pubs all our lives. So we'd always wanted to get into a food business or some kind of hospitality business. But we didn't have any money. No one would back us. And then we were sat in a pub one day, and it was sort of early 2011. And like the first signs of street food being a thing were starting to happen. So, you know, there was this sort of mythical wagon in Peckham that you could get meat from, the meat wagon. And that obviously became Meat Liquor. And like those kind of cool food things were starting to happen, where you could build a brand without any money and just do it off, you know, using social media and having a great kind of great product. And they were really kind of celebratory about food. So that was starting to happen. And suddenly there was this avenue of like, well, this is happening. Seemingly no one is doing pizza, which is one of the most obvious, you know, food groups that you want to cover. And so that all came together to be like, let's do this. Let's start a pizza company.
And how did it go from that to actually starting? what was that journey
well, that
like?
So that was the first thing. I remember going down to the meat wagon in a car park in Peckham. We'd been talking about opening a pub, but you need money to start a pub, and it just wasn't going to happen. So then suddenly this ambulance was serving 300 burgers a night to a whole bunch of people. They'd just tweet where they were. I don't know. I think it's the only time in our lives we've ever like caught a wave and been actually involved in something as it was happening. And yeah, the whole street food thing happened. So I, years before, had been and done a cookery course in Italy, and we were using pizza ovens. And the original idea was that I was going to come back and we were going to start a pizza oven company. Because it was like the strap line was going to be a barbecue with a roof for English people, because it rained so much in English summers. But then, and it's kind of got, no, I didn't get anywhere down the way with that, but that was the idea. And then Jamie Oliver started a pizza oven company. I was like, probably leave him to it. So then this idea, it definitely became clear that like having a cool van was a thing. There was like already beginnings of like, what is the starter kit for a street food thing? And just these little three-wheel Piaggio Apes that I'd driven when I was on that course. They're just so much fun. And then it was just like, what if you put a pizza oven in the back of one of those ridiculous little tuk-tuks? And I Googled it, and it was such a good sign when you Google it, and it's nothing there.
Mm.
And so I was like, oh my God, this hasn't been done before. So then this idea of, and then...
Oh, and then I stepped in and was like, we must contact Piaggio and see if this can be done. So we contacted them. They're like, it absolutely cannot be done. Like, do not do it. It will not work. We were like, got you, Piaggio. We're going to put your decades of engineering experience to the side and just ignore you. And so the idea was starting to come together. And then I had quit my job literally the day after this pub thing and then realized I needed to get another job. And as I quit my job, I emailed a very senior person in the agency I worked in who I'd never met, who was leaving to start a bakery in Cambridge. And I just said, look, I'm going to start a pizza company. You're going to start a bakery. We should at least go for a beer. And we did. And it turns out that her husband was a food critic. He's called Tim Haywood. He's a food critic for the FT and various other places. And he was just that kind of like spark of enthusiasm where we're like, this is the idea. He was like, oh my God, this is amazing. You've got to do it. You've got to go here. You've got to make it into a TV show. This is a whole thing. And he just like was this kind of, you know, this sort of surface of which we could kind of crystallize the idea. And from there, we just dived in with both feet. And we did actually end up recruiting a TV, you know, sort of slightly ropey TV company. And we went and did it with, I mean, I'm going to be honest, it was like.
We did the whole thing on a shoestring. We shot for 30 days straight. And by the end, we were just like, so we drove the Sappo back. We'd done no planning. So we turned up in Italy. And we'd literally put into Google Maps, Sicily, London, how long to drive it. And it said, I don't know, 20 hours. So let's make a holiday out of it. Let's make it 10 days. Let's really luxuriate in this. Got in the Ape first thing, turned it on, drove it, and it went 12 miles an hour. And we were like,
ooh.
Oh.
Yeah.
So we figured out that the way to figure out Piaggio Ape speed is to take the driving speed and the walking speed on Google Maps and divide them by two.
Average,
you get the average. And it, so it took 6 weeks to get home.
Oh, wow.
So we ended up making this TV show. I mean, it was quite great that we went with a really small production company because every other production company would have gone, see ya.
Yeah.
But they were like, okay, cool, we're in. And we ended up shooting this like travel documentary of us coming back and it was
surreal. And to be fair, like they took the risk on like two complete Muppets. And yeah, it was an amazing experience. And the thing that was great about it was the TV camera. Like, because it looked sort of semi-professional, it got us into places that, you know, it's kind of like, oh, I couldn't possibly tell you the recipe. It's my grandmother's grandmother. And then you get the TV camera out and they'll tell you everything.
Yeah.
And they'll tell you twice to camera. So it was like, oh, amazing. Okay. So it really opened some doors and made it kind of feel more legit. But then the show, it did eventually air on Food Network. And I think it had sort of 25 to 27 viewers, something like that.
No, but we were big in Lagos, Nigeria.
Oh, wow.
It's on hard repeat, apparently.
Yeah.
And actually in Italy, it gets shown quite a lot on National Geographic. So the only place that we've ever been stopped in the street is in Italy. Of like, oh my God, you're the two Muppets of the yeah. Piaggio Ape.
And if you went to Lagos.
If we went to Lagos.
You'd be big celebrity.
Well, do you remember there was that story a few years back where there were people flying... They were get very rich people in Lagos were getting people to fly to London to buy pizza and taking it back to Lagos. I just wonder whether we might have been involved in that little story.
Did you make that story up?
Do you not remember that story? It was a completely mad one.
That's so mad. Because by the time you're back, like, surely the pizza is not that delicious.
No.
So you started a street food business. And then how did that go? And then how did that develop into the business that exists now?
It was a... I just generally remember starting the street food van, like, and can't believe that we got the street food van open. And then just, like... My brain couldn't compute what opening a restaurant was. That was kind of the next natural step. A few of the guys who'd done street food before us, like Meat Liquor, and at that point, Pick You had opened a restaurant as well. And it was just that I just remember not being able to think how the hell you'd do that. I mean,
But quite genuinely, you know, I think everyone wants to kind of sort of unpick this story now, but quite genuinely, we started the business in March 2012, sorry. And I was like, look, I'll do this for a summer because I hate advertising that much. But I'd kind of worked out in the back of a fag packet. There was just no way that this business could support both of us. So I was like, I'll do it because it'll be a great thing that I can kind of put on my CV. But realistically, this is going to be your thing to run. You're the foodie person. And I will, you know, I'll kind of melt away into the background and it'll be this really fun events business. That was the idea. But yeah, and we just had this first summer in Soho and it was busy. And we, you know, because it was Soho, I had like people coming up being like, oh, I organise V Festival. Can you come and do that? And, we, you know, I've got this event happening. Can you come and do that? And by the end of the summer, it was like, okay, well, this is kind of going one way. And at that point, the TV show was kind of, it was due to come out. So the promise of it was like way more impressive than the actual end game. So we found ourselves in this place where like the business was sort of growing, got to the end of the summer. We weren't making any money, but we weren't losing any money anymore. And it was like, well, maybe there is something here. And so that was the first point, end of that first summer, where we were like, maybe this is something that could support both of us. But if it is going to be, it's going to have, should probably be a restaurant. And then we had a winter and was like, it's definitely going to have to be a restaurant.
Walls, I want walls.
Ceilings.
I just remember being like, there was such a hit and hope attitude. Like, there was nothing to lose. I've kind of just accidentally stumbled across an absolute cliche.
That's entrepreneur thing.
But it was just, that was really easy because it meant there was no panic around if you messed up. It was like, okay, cool, just go back and get jobs again. So
I think it's actually quite a crucial point though. A lot of people say to me, you know, if they're working in, you know, I don't want to, but, you know, some kind of professional services job. They're like, oh, you know, how did you take the risk? And like, we were 25 and 27. We didn't have a mortgage. We didn't have kids. We weren't married. We had jobs that we hated that didn't pay very much. There was no risk. Like, and that is the time to do it. I think the danger is that everyone perceives it as this massive thing you're taking. But for us, like, it feels riskier now than it felt then.
Yeah.
Because there's actually something to lose. Do you know what I mean? It's a strange thing. So I think taking that plunge, I would just really encourage people. I know we're kind of diving into recommendations, but like, just don't worry about the risk too much, because once you're 40 and you have got the kids and the mortgage, it's much, much, much harder.
Entrepreneur cliche number two, not doing it is the risk.
No, it is so true. And lots of entrepreneurs that I speak to in the podcast say about not having a business plan at the start has actually really benefited them, because they weren't trying to stick to something and they weren't putting that pressure on it.
Yeah.
They were just seeing where it went, and that's really exciting. And that, I think that is a nice way to do it if you can.
What was that someone said? Like, someone said it to me, and I feel like that actually is one of those kind of annoying cliches, but it really rings true. It's like strong convictions weakly held. So like, have a strong point of view, be like, this is what we want to do. But as soon as you have any kind of data to support that is not the right way, change it.
Mm.
So I thought that was a really nice summation. Strong convictions weakly held is good. Mm. I back that up.
Not being too fixed, one way of doing things.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah.
So talk to me about finances. So you had to start...
in 10 minutes.
Yeah. You had to open a restaurant. You wanted to open a restaurant. Like, that's a big thing going from a street food business. So like, what did that look like?
Yeah. We were like, comically naive. We'd started the business literally on a Barclay card, and we were making a bit of money on the market, but like, I think we paid each other £100 a week, something like that. So it was pretty like hand to mouth, and then you'd go and do a festival and make a bit of money. But I mean, we were so far from having any money to invest in a proper venture. And then once we decided that the kind of a restaurant angle was the way to go, we felt like we were building a name for ourselves, it was like, right, we need to go and find someone with the money to do it. And so we started kind of approaching anyone we had met over the years that had some interest. And it, you know, long story short, James's godfather, bizarrely, who we hadn't seen for like, what, 10, 15 years? 15 years, probably. He had started a pub company with our dad, who had sadly passed away at this point. Anyway, he was just coming out of that bit of his life, and we like approached him out of the blue and said, look, we haven't seen this 15 years, but we would love to chat to you about this idea. Went to pitch it to him. He was like, no, pizza is saturated, don't get it, not for me. And then we kind of went away again, did a bit more of the end of the summer, like got a bit more detail about the book and the TV show that was coming out, and like, I went back again like three or 6 months later, and we're like, we really think there's something here, like there's just something new about what we're trying to do here. And he kind of second time around was convinced, and basically he brought a whole load of like his lot along, and it was quite good because we got like 15 investors, all of whom put between like 10 and 20 grand in. So we had no one we were like massively beholden to, but we had a lot of people who had experience and interest and like wanted to come along for the ride and were there to help. So it was actually a really cool way to do it. And so yeah, we raised 300 grand to open Dean Street. Which, you know, sickeningly, you spent most of it on like premium and lawyers, and then I think we spent like 70 grand fitting it out. We'd started the market in March 2012, and we opened Dean Street 1st of August 2013.
So it's pretty quick from when you actually started to
Yeah, that. It was pretty, and we were just so like all in, because between that we also started this like supper club thing called Fours of Win, which our friend Bash runs in Peckham now. It's now called Fours of Wine, but we had just thrown everything we had, like every hour of every day at.
Well, we spent the motto was for the first 18 months, say yes to everything. Like, just don't shut down any opportunity, just go for it. I mean, I don't know what we were thinking. Like, that wasn't us before. There was something clicked at when we started the business, because that was not our attitude before we started the business. I don't know what it was. It was kind of, I suppose, I think you just get a bit, we were definitely a bit drunk on like not being employed anymore in a good way. Just kind of like, oh my God, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
So yeah, we just kind of said yes to everything. And that definitely led to us you know, we opened too many doors at the beginning. We started the limoncello business, which
sadly no longer with us.
Sadly no longer with us. Pizza is more popular than limoncello. You heard it here first. and yeah, we started with our friend Bash. We started this thing Forza Win on a roof, but it was all those kind of mad experiences. Like, you know, we built a 3-ton brick oven on the roof of a production company in Shoreditch, and there was no lift, so we carried every brick up, and all that stuff just kind of like, I don't know, is you just the experiencing it at the beginning is the most important thing, and then that's how you get people on board. People are excited to come and be part of something that's actually like living and breathing and sort of a bit rough around the edges. I think for us, we're not very good at the whole perfectionist, like putting forward a very perfect brand idea. So our best bet is to be as kind of like authentic warts and all as possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that served us well, I think, over 10 years.
Do you think perhaps it was like the momentum of like these things starting to happen and then more things come to you and you just want to run with that, those opportunities, so you're saying yes to everything?
Exactly that. And it was just like, it was just fun stuff as well. I think that was the thing. Like, it, you know, I don't think we could have started a fintech business because I just don't think we'd have had that like, you know, drive to get to the almighty dollar. It was just like, do you want to come and do this 80s festival VIP section and be on the stage with Bonnie Tyler? Yes, we do. Like stupid stuff like that. It was just like, oh, cool, this is amazing. I used to work in an office.
We did a special pizza that weekend called the Cheesney Hawks, and Tom was on the front of the counter, and we suddenly noticed that five back on the front on the queue was Chesney Hawks. And then we were like, oh, shit, what do we do? And then it was like, we gave him, he ended up ordering the pizza, fair play to him.
Got the picture, he was totally
chill.
You said to him,
and what time are you playing? And he's like, oh, I'm not. And it was like,
he'd just come to see his mates.
Sorry. Really?
But he was the nicest guy about it.
He was like, great.
I love that he ordered the pizza.
He did. It was just like an incredible thing. Like, we've gone with the Cheesney Hawks plan and Chesney Hawks is here. What do we do? but yeah, I mean, it was genuinely kind of this like, just feeding off that kind of, that fun energy of like, you know, of new things coming at you, but it was interesting when the restaurant opened. That did change quite a lot. Suddenly, you've got like an address. An address is like a scary thing for a business to have because you just get everyone coming at you for, you know, admin basically. So yeah, I think the restaurant opened and it was chaos, absolute chaos. I was the manager, you were the head chef, and you know, we were kind of learning as we went. We got 2-star reviews from Metro, Time Out, and Evening Standard on day one. That was awesome. Great start. And we had no air conditioning, and it was like August, and you couldn't sit downstairs because it was just like impossible. I mean, everything was done on the fly, and I think it was just that, like, you know, that kind of like, we're trying our best here that got us through.
But at that time, like the 2009 to 2012 kind of phase of restaurants in London, it was like, that's, you know, Polpo had opened, and that was a... That was deemed to be like really sort of, you know, not formal and a bit, oh, isn't good? You just get small little plates and you just turn up and they serve wine and little beakers. You just forget what restaurants were like in the kind of early 2000s and 90s. There was so much more formality to it. So I think London was definitely quite excited about street food and that kind of rough around the edges. It felt a bit more American, and the fact that we were a complete shambles, I think, was actually quite nice. As a sort of like, it felt like a local pizzeria in Soho. I mean, we're right opposite, you know, we're on the corner of, it's us, and the other side is Pizza Express.
Yeah.
So it was like, there was this real stark, like, which one are you going to choose? The slick operators or the Muppets who are kind of...
That moment where BuzzFeed did a list of, like, top 10 food mistakes you can make in London, and number one was go to Pizza Express when pizza pilgrims are over the road.
That was
it
nice.
Was just like, oh, my goodness.
Did that make up for the 2-star Metro reviews?
No, nothing will ever make up for that. Just burn deep into my soul.
Yeah, that always hurts. Bad reviews. When people say they don't care, it just, there's no way. You can't get on the tube in the morning, open the paper and go, oh, that's about me, then that's really awful. That's fine. I'm water off a duck's back.
How much do you think the success of that site was, and like the launch was, because it was in Soho? Like if it was somewhere else in London, do you think it would have had that response?
Well, we were already trading in Soho on Berwick Street, and we'd been doing it for a year. So by that point, and we'd gone like rain or shine 5 days a week, we definitely knew at the beginning it was really important. Other street food brands were sort of moving around and popping up in different places. We're like, no, you've got to have a location that people can recommend you. Otherwise, you're just kind of a bit of a sort of moving around in ships in the night kind of thing. So we already had an audience in Soho. So when we moved to a restaurant, like it instantly worked, which, you know, was such a blessing. Because if we've had restaurants that haven't worked when they started now. And I think if we'd had that experience on Dean Street, we wouldn't have had the tools to have fixed it. And it would have just, so much is happening. That, for all the other problems that were happening, the fact that we had customers queuing at the door, right, is the saving grace.
And I think whilst we talk about it being chaos, and it was absolute chaos, like, we always were obsessed with the product. Like, the product was always good, I think. I would argue that the product's better now than it's ever been, because we kind of just, we do obsess about it. And I think that, you know, you can't build anything on something where the product isn't good. So, you know, that was always a key part of, like, people come and have the pizza. Despite some, Metro and Time Out hating it.
There's something quite useful in pizza in that, like, because it was, you know, invented as a kind of quote-unquote poverty food in the south of Italy, like, it's made of cheap ingredients. So we can go out and get the best ingredients that you can possibly get. We get it all shipped in direct from Naples. We fly out to Naples and meet our suppliers 3-4 times a year. We've never had to have that conversation about, like, chipping the quality of the product, which I think in other restaurant businesses, I think is a more tempting scratch to itch. Whereas with pizza, you don't have to have that conversation.
Yeah.
You can just go. I just love that someone said to me the other day, I had never thought about it before. If you can put £10 in someone's hand and they can go get the best pizza in the world, you can't put £30 in their hand and they can go get a better pizza. Like, it's just such a lovely product because it's it maxes out at about £10 to £15, which is such a lovely thing to be involved in.
It is. It's so nice. And it's also, it's good for, like, any time, I think. It kind of fits with every mood.
Breakfast?
Well, not exactly.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
This season of They Started It with Angelica Malin is proudly sponsored by Funderbean, a global investment and trading platform. Funderbean serves 25,000 investors from 133 countries and has over 60 companies from Europe and Asia listed on the Funderbean exchange. Funderbean's marketplace operates 24/7, 365 days a year, and has helped private companies raise more than €25 million in funding. Funderbean is a female-founded business, founded in 2013 by Kaidi Rousselep, a former CEO of Nasdaq Tallinn, who we'll be hearing from later on this series. If you'd like to explore the world of startups and growth companies, visit their website, www.funderbean.com, and give them a follow on social media, at Funderbean. Thank you to our sponsors, Funderbean. So I want to ask a bit about how it went from that to where you are now. So when did you decide to open more pizzerias, and how did that, like, expansion go, and what were the challenges of it?
And we used to sit at the end of a service in Dean Street and just be like, how does anyone run two restaurants? Like, what on earth? And we were pretty, like, steadfast that, you know, we were finding it really challenging. We were loving it, but it was challenging, and we were just not excited about expansion at all. And then, long story short, the guys from Shaftesbury, who are, like, one of the big landlords in Soho, literally came to us and said, look, we're doing this thing, it's called Kingly Court. We're kind of converting it into, like, the food court of Carnaby. And we've got this spot, and we want it to be pizza, and we want it to be you. Like, how have we made that happen? And we still went down there, and we're like, no, don't think so. It's too close to our existing one. Like, just why would we do two in Soho? Nah. And then, actually, it was one of those moments where, like, you know, everyone wants to hate on your investors, but the investors were like, guys, sit down. This is a good site. You need to do it. And we did eventually do it. I think we raised a tiny bit more money, but at that point at Dean Street, you know, we didn't have any costs, so Dean Street was making a bit of money. So we opened it for not much more. Shaftesbury were hugely supportive and still are to this day. And it just flew. Like, Kingly Court, I mean, even now it's our number one pizzeria, and it just they've done such a great job of making it this like absolute destination for foodie brands, and they still, you know, they still curate all the stuff that goes in there. Club Mexicana's just opened, like absolutely love it. Like, they've never let that level drop, apart from us, obviously. And then, and so when that happened, there was a bit of a like, okay, this really is a proper business now. Like, this really worked. And so that was the moment when we were like, let's, you know, maybe we could kind of slowly, tentatively open more. And then we opened number 3, which is Exmouth Market, which we just fell in love with, because it's just, I don't know if you've ever sat outside Exmouth Market on a sort of May evening when like it's just glorious, and we were like, this is where we want to open. And we opened that as our 3rd one, and it was a disaster. Like,
really?
We opened it and we like, you know, lost money from day one. It was just like, oh my goodness, this is so not like Soho. Why are they not all like this? And, you know, now it's great, and it's, you know, it's taken loads of time to build it up. But that was the kind of the first dose of reality that we had, I think, of just, oh, okay, so this is hard.
Mm. What was it in particular about that site, do you think, that didn't work at the start?
We'd been a bit spoilt for choice because, you know, our first 2 restaurants were in Soho, and we'd only ever traded in Soho as a street food business. So, like, just that busyness of Soho. And then suddenly you go to Exmouth Market. It's definitely got busy times, but it's not 7 days a week, lunch and dinner trading. And we just had no, again, we had none of the tools to know how to fix a site that's not trading.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't know what was going on. So, it was a smaller restaurant as well. Yeah. It was a much, much smaller restaurant. And sometimes it just takes time, especially in those kinds of areas where, you know, the people are living in the area and working there, have been there a long time, they've got their habits. You know, you just have to sit on it. It's a restaurant going to take 6 months to bed in sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Or longer. Like, it can take real time. And I think, you know, that's the kind of classic, you know, don't give up after your first album type thing, you know.
But I think that's where we started learning, like, you know, marketing in terms of like local marketing, not kind of Twitter and Instagram stuff, like knocking on doors, giving out bounce back cards, come and have a half price pizza on us. We started a market stall. We did something called, because there's an amazing food market in Exmouth Market, and we were like, how do we do a market stall? We can't take an oven out there. So we came up with something called pizza soup, which actually I will hold down was one of the greatest things we ever did, but didn't sell. But it was like a Nonna style tomato soup.
Right.
Like really sort of chunky, hearty tomato soup served with a little mozzarella calzone on the side. I think we called it a dipping calzone.
Dipping calzone.
And we had one customer who, no joke, came every day.
Yeah.
5 days a week for the sort of 6 months that we did it, he was there.
He was the only
customer. I mean, it sounds delicious.
The world wasn't ready, but I think now there's
I think
there's
it's
time.
The name. I think pizza soup, it sounds like it's just going to be a sort of a pulverized
pizza. A blended mm-hmm. pizza, yeah. It's a good point.
I think it just needs a rebrand.
Rebrand. All right. Coming cool. to a pizzeria near you.
Bring it back.
But yeah, so that, you know, that was that first moment, and then, you know, it's been this constant like internal battle, really, of like not wanting to, you know, a big part of us didn't want to grow at all, but actually you need to grow because all the people who are coming up through the company, all the great people you employ, they need opportunities and like places to grow into. So that pretty much is the number one driver for us growing the business, really. But you know, as opportunities came to us, and you know, we had some good ones and we had some more challenging ones. But, you know, we've tried to grow at a pace where we're never kind of overwhelmed, but we're also kind of very good at diving in with both feet into things that we don't understand and then trying to figure them out afterwards.
As a business, is there any moves that you've kind of really regretted or kind of big mistakes that have happened along the course of your journey?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, plenty, plenty, plenty. I mean, to me, most of them revolve around people. It's like all about getting the right people. And I think certainly for me, like early days, I was like, right, you know, we want to be a good employer. That involves like just carrying anyone who needs carrying through a problem. And like being completely honest, like what if you've got a team of 10 and one person who needs carrying, you're not helping the one, you're letting down the 9. And that was the thing I think we got wrong a lot in the early days of like, okay, we really want this person to get through. Like, how are we going to get there? How are we going to get there? And we'd work and work and work at that. But actually, all the rest of the team were like, well, I don't have to put up with this. Like, why do I have to put up with this person who's not turning up on time or whatever? And I think that, you know, that has applied to every level. So there are so many examples of... I remember one manager in Kingly who would just never turn up on time. We even, to the point, we bought her an alarm clock.
We did, yeah.
It was literally like, it was just like anyone else would have been, no, this is not...
We're quite conflict averse, I think. And I think sometimes you could, like, sometimes it works. Use a bit of comedy, like give them an alarm clock, like, turn up to work tomorrow, and then the joke didn't land, and then it's like we've tried it the funny way.
Yeah,
but yeah, that whole learning how to, because I think also there's a massive timing thing. You know, when someone might be working with us and it's just not we're just not in tune at that time. So, you know, for them they should be moving on to another opportunity, to moving on to a different thing. We've definitely also had situations where we've felt like we've had managers in restaurants where we felt they've been there for so long, like we can't pull that pin. That the whole team will fall apart because they, you know, they're the kind of like matriarch of the whole team, and you just think they're so important. And then you have had the whole conversation. You said, listen, this isn't working. I think at that time it was the person who just wouldn't turn up on time, and it's like, I'm so sorry. And so we took that person out of the business, and kind of the opposite thing happened, where all the people below flourished.
Yeah.
Entrepreneur cliche number four. Fell the biggest tree in the forest, and the smaller shoot shall grow. There was a bit of that going on. But it was really great. He suddenly saw the assistant manager, two junior assistant managers, suddenly went, cool, and we gave them the job, and they just went, doof. Yeah. And then, so that was Nina and Karina, and yeah. Nina went on to go and run Oldroids.
Yeah.
And it was just so cool. And actually, Karina went back to New Zealand to go become a midwife, so that went a different direction. But
like, I'm sure she brought some pizza skills with her.
Yeah, it's just, it's just a lot of HR on the go. And I think when Hayley, our HR director, joined us, like, we really started to learn how you actually do it. And it's amazing watching a proper HR person, like, because you have to be completely two different people. You have to be the strict parent and you have to be the culture and the authority bit. It's such a hard, I think it's the hardest job in the business to get right.
Because I think, you know, the other way to go with people is to be too ruthless and be like, anyone who's not right is out immediately. And I think actually some of our greatest successes of business are when we've gone, no, this person is right, maybe they're on the wrong seat.
Yeah.
But like, if we move into there, that's what they're great at. And you know, there are so many examples of people in the business now where they started in one place, it wasn't working. And like, you know, I guess one of the things, again, cliche number five, trust your gut. Like really, if you believe in that person, like you can make it work. And I think, but you've got to know when you're like, I just don't believe in this person. Mm. And it's not going to work for us.
What are some of the particular challenges with hospitality as a whole for hiring and growing a team?
I mean, the number one thing for me is like sort of the UK's perception of hospitality. It really upsets me. And I know it's sort of a thing that I would say, but for whatever reason, this country just does not respect hospitality as a career choice because, you know, perceived tough hours and tough working practices. And certainly in the 80s and 90s, I'm sure that was true. People like Gordon Ramsay do not help the perception that it's a nice place to work. But the honest truth is that, like, I really believe that if everyone did 1 or 2 years in hospitality, not only would everyone be better at dealing with people, the world would be a better place. And whatever you go on to do, you'd be better at. So if you want to be a lawyer, go and get your law degree, then come and do a year or two in hospitality. You'll have a great time. You'll like, you know, you'll be out having, you know, meeting young people. Just you'll learn so much about interacting with humans. And then go and be a lawyer. And I guarantee you'll be a better lawyer than you would have
been. We call it national service industry.
National service
and
industry.
And it just like, the coolest thing about working in hospitality, especially if you're younger, and we definitely say like, some people are lifers and some people develop and grow right the way through the business. And, you know, our business is full of those people. But we also have a lot of people who should only be with us for 3 years, and they'll come in, they're young, and you talk about, you know, Tom went to Oxford, did everything he should do, got the degree, by the age of 26 was managing one person and was on $22,000 a year at an ad agency. Whereas, you know, we use the example of Gabri joined us. He came to England from Italy. His English was not great. He joined us as a waiter. You know, within a year, he was a GM with us and he was earning...
He joined us as a KP, as washing dishes.
KP. And he was, you know, within a year, he was earning $28,000 plus a 30% bonus. He was managing a team of 20 people from all over the world. He was dealing with tough customers, you know. So his people skills went through the roof immediately. And he was, you know, he was running a business, so he got a good understanding of finance, he got an understanding of employing people. And after 2 years...
No, he was with us for 6.5 years.
But after 2 years, he was like ready to go and like was, and then now he's running his own pizza business.
He's left to go and start his own pizza business. And it's just like, that's not us. That's the power of hospitality. Like it's an amazing, amazing thing. And you just need to get the kind of the baby boomer generation to not be like, oh, my daughter or son has said they want to work in hospitality.
It's weird though, because it's so uniquely English.
Yeah.
Like America, service is like heralded. And in on the continent, in Europe, like being in the restaurant industry is like, you know, it's applauded. Like, and you know, there's a real art to it, a craft. England just has always had this pretty weird relationship with hospitality.
Yeah.
And I couldn't actually put my finger on where that is, to be honest.
No, I really can't. It's a really weird one. But I think it's fundamentally wrong. And that's the biggest challenge that we come across is like, how do we get people to... Because I think the big mistake is that everyone talks about it as like it's a big career opportunity. It really can be, and you can really make real money and really develop yourself. But it can also just be a great first job. Mm. And I think that's
the
bit.
And great fun.
And great fun. Mm. And I'm obsessed with, like, you know, Adam Buxton talked on his podcast last week about, you know, he's obviously now a super successful comedian dude, but he was harking back to, you know, one of my favorite times of my life was working in a pizzeria. First time I'd left home, like, you know, it was kind of like freedom, but it was fun. It was like a bit edgy. And like, I want more people who are successful to come out and talk about that formative hospitality experience, because I guarantee there are hundreds of them.
Yeah. My first job was working in catering at Lord's, and I was serving the media box like all throughout the summer, and I had the best summer of my life. So much fun. Made amazing money and tips, and just like, you know, was there with the cricket and everyone was having a good time.
I know. It's a really strange issue that we need to solve.
I did then work in a pub and got fired for pulling too many free pints.
Well, there you go. It's a good way to get fired.
Went out with a bang. I want to talk a little bit about the pandemic. So March 2020, everything shuts. What do you guys do? What's your response? And then, like, coming out of it, what's that experience been like as well?
Yeah, it's funny now that we've had a bit of a chance to kind of slightly reflect on it.
Yeah.
I think this is going to come and sound weird. We both kind of loved certain aspects of it. Like, it really, I don't know, maybe it felt a bit more street food again. It felt like startup. And I think we both enjoy working in a startup business because there's this kind of thinking on your feet. You know, again, like, you talked about how you suddenly felt a bit sort of a relief because it was like, if everything goes wrong now, like,
there's
such anxiety was like, I'm going to mess this up eventually. So the fact that someone has done it for me actually is quite relieving. Like,
but it was interesting watching how different...
Yeah, I think a lot of people felt that, though. Also, that kind of creative freedom with your careers. Like, if you couldn't do the job you were doing, it gave you... So many people started businesses in the pandemic because you were suddenly free.
It was so nice to have something that just, like, completely disrupts everything. And, like, it just... I know, it's quite refreshing in a way.
But I think the very early days were horrendous because, obviously, like... We didn't know. That first Monday when Boris was like, we're closing everything. Or no, he didn't close everything. He said, don't go to restaurants. And our sales just dropped to like near enough zero. And we had a whole, we have a load, big team of people. And we're like, how are we going to deal with this? Because we're losing tens of thousands of pounds a day, basically, so all of a sudden. And I think various companies dealt with it in different ways. We're like, what we're going to do is we're going to stay open everywhere. We're going to trade as hard as we can, which was not very hard because no one was coming. But you know, we're going to just do as much as we can to protect as many jobs as we can and hope that like some kind of white knight comes in. And obviously on the Friday of that week, you know, they turned up with the furlough scheme and we were all there like, you know, is it going to be 40% covered? Is it going to be 60%? And when he announced it was going to cover 80% of everyone's wages, it was just like this amazing. I still get goosebumps now. Just like, holy shit, like, these people are going to be okay.
Mm.
We're all going to be okay. And it was just the relief. You know, we had, at that point, 250 employees. And I think by the next week, we had 248 on a furlough.
Wow.
Yeah.
Like, absolutely unbelievable. And then we had 2 weeks of like, okay, cool. Everyone's okay. Like, you know, we've probably got away with this. Sun's out.
We had a hilarious moment where we were like, the six of us who kind of, you know, me, Tom, finance director, office director, we were sitting in our office and we had the screen up and we were doing the numbers on like, worst case, we called it the doomsday scenario, which was, I think, a 12-week closure.
This was before lockdown had started.
And we were like, boom, and Sophie, our finance director, hit return, and the number went, and it came out, and we were like, oh, okay.
I think we're going to be all right.
We can probably get over there. This is all right. And then she's like, oh, no, sorry, missed the decimal. And it just went, and that was on like a 12-week closure. We were like, oh my God.
We called that the Armageddon scenario, 12-week closure. And it was...
And then how long was it?
Oh, I mean, it was, all told, it must have been like 5, 6, 7 months closed.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then another further 5 or 6, like, then able to trade in certain ways.
But after that initial panic and just the pandemonium and all that and trying to get everyone, you know, on furlough and getting make sure everyone had money coming in and closing all the restaurants, there was a sort of, I think the whole country felt, the whole world felt it, I suppose. Like, once everyone had kind of got a bit sorted and everyone got into the routine of what it was and what was happening and stay home, then we took a breath and we're like, cool, what do we do now? Like, what should we do? And this, it was actually an idea that we'd had back in 2014, which was, it was basically a frying pan pizza. We'd started, the idea of a frying pizza came around because in 2011, when we'd fitted the oven in the back of the pizza van, we invited 50 friends around to come and test out the thing at Louis's house.
Yeah.
And then we hadn't got the oven hot enough. So like, oh my God. So we suddenly started making pizzas in dry frying pans and putting them under a grill to just kind of replicate the heat of the oven. And then 2 years later, we were like, okay, cool, this is actually quite fun. We should make a pizza box with little pots in it. This is 2014. And you can come in and we'll just put two portions of sauce, two dough balls, and close it up. And you can take that away and make it at home. And it failed miserably. But it's a good lesson in, like, keep the bad ideas on the shelf.
Yeah.
Because we had that idea ready to go. Like, as soon as the dust had settled on lockdown, it was like, boom, let's go. And so we were like first to market with a, with this restaurant kit idea.
So we opened, we had our, after the team had initially been like, we're terrified to go out, we don't know what this is. We had the first people starting to go, I want to come back. So we opened our Victoria site for Deliveroo because we had no rent because it was a new site, it was still rent free. So we opened that and we're like, what else could we do? And then this idea came together. James like, let's try it. Sent me one in the post and it was just a complete car crash.
But we found, because there's like freezers, we used this like Woolcool, which is like a sheet, it's a wool-based insulation system that actually gets used mostly in the medical industry. And we were like, maybe you could ship fresh food in a box using that stuff and a couple ice packs.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, we're not doing
so we put that first Wednesday we opened, we put 50 up for sale and we put them on Instagram. We were like, you know, it'd be cool if we could sell 50 in a week. I mean, it's not going to make any money, but it'd be a cool like Instagram thing. We sold that 50 in 20 seconds. It was like,
wow.
Oh, okay. And then we did 50 again the next day, and again they sold in 20 seconds. And I was like building the Shopify site like as this was happening, and you could see that I think like something like 350 people had tried to put one in their basket in the first minute of it going on sale on the Thursday. So on the Thursday we were like, right, we have two choices: we either do this in a kind of calm, measured, sensible way, which is like slowly build our production ability, like slowly ramp up our sales.
Why do I feel like that's not the way you went
or
for it?
Get on eBay,
get as many sold as you can and then work out how you fulfill it. So we were like, what's
most
we can do? So on the Friday morning, we put 1,100 kits up for sale at 9 a.m.
Oh,
and we sold them all by 9:50. And it was still our busiest hour of trading in the history of the company.
And for the first month or so, we were working on borrowed time because we figured out that nobody was going anywhere. So no one actually cared what day this kit arrived. It was like, if it can arrive, at one point it was like, it will arrive at one day in the next month.
Yeah, no, it was literally like, exactly, pay us 25 quid now, and at some point in the next like 6 weeks, a kit will arrive.
And if anything, it kind of added to the joy because the CRM, there was nothing of that. So like the email coming out saying you're going to get your kit tomorrow didn't exist. So people would literally just pay 25 quid, then like 3 weeks later, they'd be like, open the door.
Day of their life, yeah.
And so it kind of added to this like, oh, weird.
It just went absolutely bonkers. Like we doubled our Instagram following. You were doing like reviews of everyone's pizzas. We were getting all this messages being like, this is the happiest day of lockdown. Mm. Like, you know, we had everyone from like Stormzy to the Spice Girls to all these people did the kits, and it just
is that your cultural that's your bandwidth. Stormzy to Spice
Girls. I've been
Girls.
On S in my iPod today. iPod, that's another little cultural reference for you. So it just went mad, and it, you know, at one point, so then it was literally like, go to Curry's, buy as many freezers as you can get to like put ice packs in. Turns out if you fill a Curry's freezer with like unfrozen ice packs, you don't open it the next morning and they're frozen. You don't open it the next 3 days and they're frozen. It takes like 10 days to freeze them. So there was loads of just like...
It's so funny when you jump into... You just get really into the detail on the most stupid thing. You have moments where you go like, what am I talking about? You're on the phone to the ice pack company and you're going, so are you saying that the way that we put the ice packs into the freezer, yeah, because as they get sharper, they can puncture the bags. And then so then you just get so in the weeds with all this detail.
In
and it's kind of fun and it's kind of also really stressful because if a problem goes, because we were doing, how many were we doing a day on a peak like lockdown?
So
like 1,000 a day?
February 21, we were doing 10,000 a week.
Wow.
And if you make a mistake, if you put the wrong amount of yeast in or you don't, or someone doesn't close the lids properly, that is like, it so perfectly multiplies as 10,000 because everyone's the same. So you'd wake up at 6 a.m. and be like, hi, my, the dough balls seem to have popped out of the thing. They've kind of overproved. Oh, and then you just go, oh, today's going to be a bad day. Yeah. We're going to have a lot of emails to send.
Because it's all of them.
We were just working so hard to make it great. And, you know, we were just up against it. But joking aside, it saved Pizza Pilgrims for sure. Like, you know, thank you to everyone that bought one because it genuinely, you know, it genuinely made a difference. And we, you know, it kept us busy. You know, we weren't sitting there kind of like worrying about the future of it. And it, you know, in so many ways, like there are people now who live in Bath or Bristol or Edinburgh or Skegness who've bought a pizza kit who had no reason to connect with us before.
Mm.
So it has been a bizarre, you know, in many ways, success story.
Have you found people's dining habits have changed since we've come out of the pandemic?
Yeah.
Like, what are you seeing?
People are drinking more.
Fair.
Basically. I think it's like, if I'm going out, I'm going out.
Yeah.
I
interviewed the CEO of Virgin Atlantic the other day, and he said that they doubled the amount of champagne that they have on board because it was...
Because everyone's just having it back in the moment.
Because travel's so stressful and everyone was just...
Yeah. No, we're definitely seeing that. And I think, you know, one of our challenges as a business is we don't have an outlet for that. We don't have like a menu where you can, if you want to go and be a big spender, you can't, because there's only so much pizza you can eat.
Two pizzas.
Yeah, so, you know, it's probably one of our limitations. But I think, you know, also it's just great to still be protecting that. You know, I think our average spend is like £14. So, like, as an experience, you know, with all the horror that's coming in the next 6 months on, you know, living costs, we still feel like we can be, you know, a night out at a good price, which feels really nice. And certainly we set out to do that in day one. It's like, we want to be great, but great value.
Absolutely. So you've touched a little bit on kind of entrepreneurship and mindset, but I just love some takeaways from you guys. What do you think has been like some of the most important things around your entrepreneurship journey that has helped you in times when it has been challenging in terms of mindset and staying positive about the business?
I think the pandemic thing was the only way. It's like, I think you just got to always lean towards the positive. Like, how hospitality is about putting a smile on someone's face. So, like, in any scenario, it's how do we move the business in that direction? And that, so that could be like internal, that can be for the team, or that can be for the customer. But like, and you've always, you know, it's a cliche number six, it's got to be solution focused. Everything, if you start looking at problems, not solutions, then it's just an absolute spiral to nightmare.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, and I think if you look at something the right way, there's always a way of looking at it where you can, there's a route through, and it's a solution. I don't think there's never a dead end. I think is a good way of looking at it.
Looking at solutions. If you were to go back and give yourself some advice starting out at the beginning of your journey, what would you say to yourself?
I really think, you know, it's the trust your gut thing. Like, you know, it's your idea. You know better than anyone else what you feel is the right thing to do. And I think the amount of times where we've done something, and actually if I'd really looked deep down into my soul, I would or wouldn't have done it, and it's ended up being the wrong decision. I feel like, you know, you've got to know what you're about. I think the other thing that, you know, I find really interesting about this journey is that, you know, investors are kind of made out as this like comedy, evil kind of Mr. Burns troupe, where they're like, you know, they're just the bad guys, and you're kind of, everyone's just sort of serving them, and they're like all just counting money in the background. I think the truth about that is that probably stems from the fact that they're often the guys who are not in the room. So any difficult decisions you're making, you're like, well, the investors, you know, they said that we've got to do that thing because, you know, horrible people. But actually, you know, we have been like sponges to like our investors, and just like constantly reached out to them to just like get their opinion, or like learn from them, or get their point of view. And like, we've learned so much by just listening to them. And like, you know, the fact is that it's not, you know, what they were doing 40, 50 years ago. Yes, if you were running a social network, it's probably not as relevant, but pubs in the 60s were pretty much the same as pubs in the 2020s. And so like, those lessons that they learned are still valuable lessons. Mm. And I think, you know, we had no interest, for example, in like finance team. We're like, oh, we'll just outsource it. Who cares? Like, you know, just we're more interested in this bit. And actually they were like, no, you need to have someone in-house, you need to understand your numbers, you need to get, and actually, you know, it's such been a great lesson of like, actually a P&L can tell you more about a business than anything else. I know that's like obvious to a proper business person, but neither of us have got any experience. I didn't know the difference between net and gross profit until like year two of Pizza Pilgrims.
Still then.
Still learning. Is there anything you would go back and do differently? Any big things that stand out?
Hot dogs. So much easier.
Hot dogs.
Or chips.
Chips.
The guy who's at the festival running the chip stall is winning life.
Yeah.
Apart from he has to smell like chips at the end of the day.
Yeah, and you can't really open a chip restaurant.
People have. Yeah. But, and if you're, I mean, the Belgians would have quite a lot to say about your opinion on chip restaurants because they are everywhere.
No, I don't think there's much. I don't know. It would be a strange way to look at it, I think, to go like, what would we change?
That's,
I think,
exactly.
The whole thing's been what it's been, and I suppose that kind of comes back to that, like, always just look at it as it is. Don't try and... So I don't think we'd change anything now.
There are millions of mistakes, but I think it is that thing of, like, it's the Back to the Future. If you go back and change it, you end up in a much worse alternate future than you ended up in before. So just, like...
Although you do get expanding pizza.
That's true.
In that weird...
That's true. That is true. That was actually a great outcome. Yeah, maybe we should have done that.
What's the most rewarding thing about running your business?
Watching amazing young people develop themselves. Like, honestly, we started just before, on I think it was 13th of March 2020, we opened our academy in Camden, which is like a semi-live pizzeria environment. So it is a pizzeria, but then it's got like classrooms at the back that can kind of expand to be part of a restaurant or shrink to be more training areas. And now all of our managers and head chefs and all of our team in some way go through it as a kind of like, this is what the gold standard is, but also as an inspiration thing and as a way to get people who, you know, are coming in off the streets or ex-cons or need like that extra leg up to get them going, they all go through it. And like, just watching people develop, and you know, some of our young guys who started as a supervisor and now they're managing teams of, you know, 25 people, smashing all their targets, delivering amazing reviews, doing it with a smile on their face and loving the challenge of it. I mean, that to me is the everything on why we do Pizza Pilgrims. If it wasn't for that, I think I'd be long gone by now.
I think something we're also getting to see a bit more recently as we kind of got a bit bigger is like, there is stuff that me and Tom are not involved in at all. And it's just so glorious. There's nothing nicer than walking into a pizzeria, walking into a meeting of an office, and there's like a whole thing happening and it's theirs. It's not ours. It's just like, oh yeah. My God, that's so glorious. It takes on a life of its own. Mm. It's just so nice to see other people owning the brand and like coming up with ideas. And then you walk in and you like the idea. That's the best bit. And you're like, awesome. I don't even need to be here. This is awesome.
Yeah, it's an amazing feeling, that, for sure.
My final question, just because I want to know for my own insights, what would be your perfect day out in London or in Soho? I heard you talking about earlier. If you were to plan a nice day out, what would you do?
For me, it would all be on Dean Street. So you start at the bottom of Dean Street and you go to the French House for lunch and you drink one of those big bottles of Normandy cider and you eat like delicious, delicious little English pâtés and stuff. It's so Soho. Sit there, get a little buzz on there, and just drift up the road and go and see a comedy gig at Soho Theatre, Dream Zones. Couple plastic glass pints in there. Then on to Pizza Pilgrims, which is number 11 Dean Street. 11 Dean Street. And have yourself a pizza and then just slip into the toucan for the rest of the night.
Perfect.
Absolutely glorious.
Is that what your day would be like?
No. I think I'd probably... I mean, mine would definitely end in Ain't Nothing But. It is just the happiest place on earth. Like, it's a blues bar on Kingly Street. I had my 21st birthday there. And they're so achingly cool. They're basically like the one company on Kingly Street that we've never made friends with because they're just like, no, like, obviously not. Look at you. You're not bluesman. Get out of my sight. But I think
it might be the phrase bluesman.
Yeah. Probably doesn't help my case.
Bluesman.
But yeah, it's just the coolest place. Like, it's always just rocking in there. And yeah, I want to end my day there. Well, I don't want to spend the rest of my day. Don't know.
Outside ain't nothing but.
Well, the one you missed on Dean Street, Barrafina. I mean, come on.
Barrafina's good.
Barrafina is good.
Very nice. Well, you've been the most fantastic guest. Thank you so much for coming to chat to me. I just have some quick fire questions that I do at the end of every episode. Because there's two of you, maybe you can take it in turns.
Okay, sure.
Okay, what's up with you? Marmite or peanut butter?
Neither.
What? Why?
Marmite. Or have you seen Marmite peanut butter?
Yes, but I've been doing that for years, like mixing them together. But
you're one of those people.
I was doing
Marmite peanut butter before it was cool.
It was so cool. I think I once tweeted at them being like, you should make this.
And Bovril peanut butter.
But it doesn't taste as good,
thing.
The one that they've made together.
Is that right?
No, yeah, it doesn't taste
I've
as good as
if
you do it.
It.
Well,
gun to my head, peanut butter, but I would choose
neither. Why neither?
They're just both gross. I mean, stupid question.
No, that's wrong. Healthy or indulgent? Almost question. I was going to say pizza faster.
As this is on camera, I cannot lie. Indulgent.
Spend or save?
Save, probably.
Interesting. I think I might be save, you know.
Really?
No, yeah.
I mean, look at us again. Like, we're on camera. Like, we're not big spenders, sadly.
Staying in or going out?
Oh, it's a good one.
I want to go out, then immediately stay in very, very hard. Can I do that?
Stay in for a long time.
Yeah.
I think I'm going out.
Yeah.
Legend.
Love or money? I wrote these when I was drunk.
I want to meet the guy that says money.
Yeah, he was sat there before you.
Hard, cold cash, please.
And then these ones are from my producers, Apple or Android?
Apple, I mean, don't even talk to me about Android. What a nonsense.
Yeah. Brogues or sneakers?
Trainers.
Yeah, I know. Sneakers. Become an American show. Well, it is on YouTube, everyone will watch it.
What is a brogue?
I'm getting married this month and I've got to decide that exact thing. Do I wear shoes, which I've never worn, or trainers, which I always wear? And
I think you have to wear shoes to a wedding.
No, I was
shooting that kind of like, oh, it's so cool, it's a suit and a suit. No, it's gonna be shoes.
This is his third shot getting married after pandemic fun times.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Brogues. For the wedding day, brogues. For life. Day. Shoes. Yeah. Trainers.
Fantastic. Well, that was all of my questions. Thank you so much, guys. If people would like to find out more about Pizza Pilgrims or follow you on Instagram, where should they go?
11 Dean Street. pizzapilgrims.co.uk. But at Pizza Pilgrim's Instagram, there is a TikTok, but we've not started using it, so don't go there.
Okay,
but
well, when Pizza Soup comes back, I want to see it on TikTok.
Pizza Soup's going to be the craze on TikTok. That's what it's
going to be. For sure. Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of They Started It with Angelica Malin. Don't forget to hit the subscribe button to get new episodes delivered weekly and follow us on social media at Jelly Malin. If you benefited from this conversation, we'd love you to leave a review and rate the podcast so more people can find it. Today's podcast is brought to you live from Runway East, who are kindly sponsoring this series of They Started It with Angelica Malin. I'm recording today at their state-of-the-art studio on Old Compton Street in Soho, and honestly, what an incredible place. As well as podcast studios, Runway East offers office solutions to businesses of all kinds. They do flexible contracts, and there's workspace options for everyone, from big branded offices to flexi co-working space. If you're interested in joining a super trendy co-working space, they've got sites in London and Bristol, with new ones opening later this year in Shoreditch and Whitechapel. Come here for cake Wednesdays and drinks trolleys on Fridays, and stay for the free coffee. Give them a follow on social media at Runway East.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.